if the value of the whiting fishery is about $90 million rationalized, my question is, there's about 35 boats that participate in that. They would then be receiving that value if they received 100% of the IMT. And what stranded capital do they have that would allow for the corporations that own boats to receive that $100 million or whatever that number is if the fishery is good? I mean, what's the rationale for them receiving this enormous value that they get? Do they have stranded capital as well? And if so, how do you measure that?
I wouldn't make the argument that they ought to get the IFQs because of stranded capital. I don't think that argument is actually the reason why we allocate to harvesters.
They aren't harvesters. They're corporations that own boats or permits. They don't harvest it. They own the boat. That's who's going to get it. It's not the people on the boat.
Can you repeat the question?
Well, we're talking about allocation of boats.
Here, Joe, use this. If you have a question, come on up to the table and speak into the mic. Everybody can hear.
You know, there's a number of things I thought of as Professor Weiland was speaking, but one was the estimated value of the whiting fishery under his model was about $90 million. And his comment was, well, the processors certainly don't deserve 25% of that because he thinks the stranded capital value that we have as processors is not anywhere near that number. I disagree with that, but that's beside the point. The real argument is, well, then that $90 million is going to go to corporations or limited partnerships or LLCs that own boats. And they don't harvest by definition. They're just boat owners. And so what's the stranded capital involved in those vessels that would then, or do they have, for example, 90% of the stranded capital in the industry, or do they have 10% of the... What's the analysis that we're looking at to look at that stranded capital in that sector of the industry?
Okay. No one that I know of who actually makes any sense on this argument has ever made the argument that harvesters ought to get IFQs because of their stranded capital. I don't know who's made that argument. I mean... So we're not justifying giving it to one group or another on the basis of stranded capital. And, you know, economists have... we have some trouble with this issue of... When people ask us who should get the value, I don't have an answer to that because that's not a scientific question. I'd like to get some of it. However, I can... You know, so I can't answer whether the processors ought to get it or the fishermen ought to get it. What I can say is whether the plan that people come up with has any effects on efficiency. For example, I can say if you give a lot of it to the processors, it'll affect the bargaining power. I can say, what's going to happen if this is allocated is that it'll go to different people up and down the coast living in different communities. When the first people who were grandfathered in sell out, a lot of that money is going to stay with wherever they're living. And so, you know, if you spread this stuff over 150 groundfish fishermen, when they sell out, it's going to be spread up and down the coast to over 150 different places where those people live. If you give it all the processors, I don't know where the processor lives. I mean, it'll be spent wherever, when they sell out, wherever they live. We worry about coastal communities. There's not a good argument about who ought to get it because this is sort of a social values question. All I can do as an economist is say, put it one place or another place, it'll have certain ramifications, which may be good or may be bad. So, I mean, Joe, I'm not arguing actually that it ought to go to harvesters because they have stranded capital. Nobody has made that argument. Why haven't they?
Why
give it to the processors? I mean, who can answer that question?
Well, that's the basic question. Why auction it off?
Well, we can do that. I mean, and we do that with fisheries that are opening up that are new fisheries. A lot of places do. As I say, this is not a question that economic science has a lot to say about. It's a value judgment.
Just one other quick point.
forgive me. Another quick point is, I don't think the issue of stranded capital has anything to do with necessarily with product form. It really is supply and demand per unit of time. And when you have an overcapitalized industry that is suddenly decapitalized through rationalization, it changes the demand for the supply or supply per unit of time of that product. So it's really the rationalization scheme that's causing the change in the system, regardless of product form. For example, in crab, there's been no change at all in product form. Same exact product form.
Well, there has been, because I'm getting fresh king crab legs in my market in Davis, and I never saw them in the past.
Well, you're getting them from Russia.
They're not actually fresh. They're frozen, but they're recently frozen.
They're getting them from Russia, actually. But
not all. No, I'm not, because we've got those red, yellow, and green stickers in my market that say where they're coming from and whether you should buy them or not.
Frozen crabs have been around forever. But it's really the issue of you have this industrialized fishery that was changed through rationalization, and at least in the North Pacific, they realized that there were impacts for both the people who own the boats, which are clearly impacted, and the people who own the plants. And it was an effort to try to recognize that in the allocation. And as well as skippers, they recognized that skippers had human capital that was devalued, so they had to be included as well. And I think that's, you know, we've had such long experience now in Alaska with halibut, pollock, which is an industry that was really rationalized along the idea that you had to include both harvesters and processors. And I think that same model, or at least the same thought process, philosophy, is what we're looking at here for whiting, at least. I'm not an expert on groundfish. I don't know anything about it. But the idea that you have these, you have to recognize both sectors when you go through the rationalization.
Let me say something about the whiting fishery here. My estimates of what its value was were based on there being a competitive market for whiting between processors and harvesters. If there isn't a competitive market for whiting, and if fishermen themselves are getting prices that are driven right down to their costs, when they actually value their ITQs, they'll be valued at nothing. Because the value is based on the expected future profitability of using those IFQs. And there's something that's sort of doubly insidious about harvester power here. One is they get the price low to begin with, but the other is by keeping the price down low, they embed and create expectations that it's going to stay low, and then when people sell out, they sell out their ITQ for low values. And if processors have the ability to buy them, they get to buy them for low values. Now, why do I say this? Well, because I've actually looked at what's happened in the fishery, the pre-AFA fishery in Alaska. Interesting thing about prices that were given to people who delivered inshore is that in real terms they were virtually constant for about 10 or 12 years. And this is in spite of the fact that what they were producing was being sent to Japan and the exchange rate was bopping up and down 60 or 70% over the same period. So how could that happen, that prices given to people who are delivering are the same over time, when the product itself is being sold in a market whose value is moving up and down? Yeah.
Dr. Wild, my name is Kent Crayford. I'm a consultant for the Processors Association. I just had a question about the premise of your study. Obviously, stranded capital is an issue after your plant has shut down, either because of a management change in this case. So my question is, you know, we've talked a lot about stranded capital. You've talked a lot about what you do with it after it's stranded. But how do you prevent it from being stranded in the first place? How do you keep the management change, in this case IQs, from putting the processor out of business in the first place?
Well, I mean, one of the things you can do is lock the system up so that it can't move. I mean, and then nothing happens. I mean, so you can freeze the system into its current situation, have landings all at the same place, make people to produce the same products, make fishermen deliver to the same place, make them use the same boats, whatever you want to do. I mean, so, you know, we have latitude if we are worried about regulation-induced changes. And we have the option just to bind the system up. And part of the issue here when you design ITQ programs is whether you want to do that. And there may be reason to do that. There may be reason, in fact, to soften the blows that occur if we anticipate fairly major changes in the structure of a system. And that's something that has to be thought about in advance. I mean, is there going to be a major change, for example, in the groundfish fishery as we move over to a new one based on IFQs, but where we're starting from one where the product is spread out over the whole season? So this is a dilemma in the design of all these. I think it is people's, it is sort of a natural thing to do to expect the worst and then protect against the worst. I think what we've seen in other instances of deregulation in other industries other than this one is that change comes really slowly, much more slowly than we think. And so the existing system, to the extent that it adjusts and adapts to new regulations, is allowed adjustment time and gets to adapt and adjust to new regulations. And, the big cost of actually freezing the system up is that you don't generate the values. There's huge values to be made by allowing people to innovate and to come up with new ideas on both the how to build a boat, how to fish, how to avoid bycatch, and how to market your product. And that has been shown all around the world to be the big money maker. I mean, it's amazing what happens. There's in every situation almost, there's a 20, 30, 40% increase in market value almost immediately. And then there's a continued and sustained increase in values that are being produced as the system matures. So, and all of that in some sense is being foregone now, in addition to, having a situation that also has lots of other problems. The bycatch issues and habitat issues and things like that, for example. I just had a student who's done a dissertation on bycatch in the head and gut fishery in the Bering Sea, and those head and gut fleet people basically got together and put together a voluntary program where they passed information around to each other about hot spots for bycatch, and they effectively came up with an idea to try to avoid bycatch. That's the kind of stuff that starts to emerge once you give the people involved in the industry a stake in the industry by giving them some security. And that's what IFQs do, is give you a security, basically, and give you the payoff for making innovations at all levels. So,
hi, my name is Richard Carroll with Ocean Gold Seafoods, and I wanted to ask if you did any kind of study on the stranded capital that occurred in the whiting fishery in British Columbia. Prior to IQs, there were, I think, 6 shore plants that operated, and after IQs, that number was reduced to 2. And what you essentially happened is the innovation was the movement of quota from these shore-based plants and from these shore-based communities into the offshore sector, and the reestablishment of a foreign joint venture, which allowed essentially the harvesting fleet to bypass local wage constraints and to bypass export tariffs and things like that.
No, I'll look at that. Thanks for telling me about that. But that is an example of a system without constraints that allowed a big shift in the activity from one type of processing to another. And of course, I don't think we don't have that. We've already sort of locked in the fraction that goes to the inshore fleet here already, so that's protected. And you could change that. You could allow it to drift over time, or you could freeze it for a while. I mean, in many of these, it's sort of important for the people in the industry to get a feel for how the system is going to work under conditions that may be somewhat close to what you've got now, and then once the system starts generating values, people start seeing the wisdom of actually opening them up and making them more flexible. That's what happens generally in most cases, is that there are worries over disruptions. They get manifested in the policy process with all sorts of restrictions on trades and things like that. And then once people actually start seeing how the system works, they start saying, well, maybe why don't you allow us to lease a little bit to those offshore guys or vice versa? And the system softens up a little bit. So I don't think there's anything wrong with binding the system up somewhat. But the fact is, if you bind it up a lot, you're not going to generate the values. So this is a balancing act in a lot of ways, and there's room to learn. I mean, you know, there are lots of things that have been done around the world that are quite interesting. Like British Columbia forbid halibut fishermen from transferring their shares permanently for a couple years. And the nice thing about that was that people got a handle on what the value of permits would be in the lease market so that they could figure out what they were worth if they wanted to sell out. And, you know, a lot of these fisheries have floundered on situations that occur where people sell out early and then regret it later because the market wasn't mature enough for them to really, for the market to really reveal what they're worth, actually. And so, but there are, as I say, there are ways to set them up to avoid what you might think is drastic dislocation and then free it up later. Any others? Good. I say I've been teaching for 5 hours today. I don't really need another 2 hours of it.
Will Stell with K&L Gates up in Seattle. Jim, a question that goes more to the EIS work, which the council is doing now in order to construct a quantitative assessment of the principal topics in designing an IQ program properly and what the alternatives should be. On this particular topic of stranded capital and whether and under what conditions and to what extent, do you think that it's able to try to quantify these types of issues with a higher degree of specificity so that we can get a sort of empirical basis to make some judgments here? Or is it all just he said, she said?
Well, I think the problem is that that everything's so secret. I mean, when we're talking about information that pertains to small number of firms, you can't get access to it with public data, even though the public data sometimes exists. And so I'm not sure how an outsider group, without cooperation of the processors, could actually estimate this thing. I mean, it seems like, in some sense, the ball ought to be in the processor's court to say, if you think that your capital is going to be stranded because of the regulations, you tell us what it's going to be, what the value is going to be, and we'll come in with a team of forensic accountants and see if this makes sense. Because it's very difficult to get information about what's going on in the sector. And I don't know how. Maybe the process itself will give access to people to do it, but I'm a little skeptical.
Dr. Wong, Ken Crayfording. I just want to make you aware, we just submitted for supplemental public comment today a study that we've done. It's more of an accounting of various statistics in the processing industry, shoreside, whiting, and groundfish industries. We didn't get the participation of all processors, unfortunately. But I think it's a good set of, good deal of information. It's aggregated, so it's not by firm, in order to protect the confidentiality of those who submitted information. But there's a copy in the back, and I'll give you a copy. It may be worthwhile in your study. It did focus more on employment and other things, not so much on capital. We don't actually have capital information because employment was really more of what we wanted to focus on. But that leads me, I guess, to just one more question, which is, you know, we've really focused in this on the number of jobs in the whiting and groundfish sectors. What about stranded jobs? I mean, how does your study account for that?
Well, I mean, I didn't account for it, but I think in some way, the principles are still the same. You still need to ask the question, is the specific policy itself going to cause changes in the nature of the operations in ways that affects labor? And I mean, that's what you have to get at. And I don't, you know, in the groundfish fishery again, as you rationalize, it seems to me that you probably need more labor, actually, because, I mean, you're going to be, in some cases, maybe processing the stuff to a higher level. It may be spread out in a different way. It has to be made commensurate. I mean, there, you know, when people looked at what has happened in crab and halibut, they talk about the jobs lost. I mean, what isn't pointed out is that the job is a five-day job that's being replaced with a nine-month job. People, you know, I think people ought to worry about, for example, whether the job losses that people are talking about, and this goes back to the halibut cases, are those five-day jobs that we lost breadwinners, or are they college kids? Do we care? I mean, I think those details actually turn out to be important in influencing how much emphasis we ought to place on some of this, on some of this stuff. I don't think anything I've said tonight is anything more than common sense. It's not tricky economics. It's accounting and common sense, actually.
I have a question that's not necessarily IFQ or CAPS. Oh, I'm sorry. Pete Leipzig with the Fishermen's Marketing Association. For those of you that don't know me. Anyway, my question is not directly related to IFQs or stranded capital, but in the IFQ package, there is an alternative that's being considered where co-ops would be developed in lieu of IFQs. And part of that alternative would be a limitation on the number of firms that would be allowed to purchase product from fishermen as part of these co-ops. Do you have any just guiding thoughts on that as people consider that?
Well, I don't want to talk off the cuff about this. I have not written about co-ops or thought about co-ops, and when I look at what's going on in Alaska, I'm actually boggled and confused about the way that system works. And so the devil's in the details in all of these co-op setups, I think. And there are ways, I think, to stifle competition between harvesters and processors, and there are ways to actually encourage it. And I think in order to do it right in ways that don't significantly affect the balance of power, you have to be very careful about how those are set up. I think there have been some unintended effects of the surprising effects from the Alaska case. And I actually have not spent a lot of time thinking about those. I think it's complicated. I don't actually fully understand it, to tell you the truth, to be able to predict. And trying to predict, actually, you know, part of the problem is trying to predict what is going to happen in a situation where the outcome is a function of bargaining is pretty hard to do, actually. I mean, it depends on who the principals are, what the rules are, what the power relationships are, and all those kinds of things. And to actually, to give you sort of a concrete opinion about that, I'm reluctant to do. But if you give me some time to think about it, I could do it some other time.
Jim Seeger, Council Staff. With respect to trying to do an assessment of total stranded capital, if we were to do that kind of an assessment, do you think it would require us to go into each plant and get an inventory of the equipment in that plant and assess its opportunity costs, or you know the other things it could be used for? Or is there some kind of a more general approach that might be taken where we don't have to know the exact equipment in every plant? That's one part of the question. The second part of the question is, are there some theories or methods by which, if some of the equipment is multiple use, using groundfish and in other fisheries, that we could parse that out to determine a portion of it that's stranded and a portion of it that would not be counted as stranded?
Well, I mean, I guess the question is, what's the best what's the best process, the most efficient process? The other is, what process are you bound to follow? I mean, you know, when you think about this, you could say, we're going to get a handle on this with staff people, and we're going to go into all the possible plants. I'm going to interview all the plant owners and talk about how they think the plant equipment is going to be stranded, and we're going to look at it, and we're going to value it. That's one way to do it. The other way is, to say to the processors, what do you think? Why don't you start us off and tell us what exactly in your plant is going to be affected by this regulatory change, and let us come look at that and narrow down the options. But I don't know what you're bound to, you know, in terms of process. But I think, you know, I think it's hard to sit back in an office and guess at it. I mean, I think you actually have to get out there and look at it and talk to people about the way the plants function and get a feel for what people are thinking. And you have to be aware, of course, that people are going to be not telling the truth. I mean, they're going to be gaming you and saying, oh, gee, you know, we know we're going to be shutting this thing down. This is not going to be easy to get at this, I think. It's cutting up lumpy equipment. Now, I mean, there are some very sophisticated, complicated theories which you wouldn't want to bother with. And so I think some simple rules of thumb are probably the best way, that sort of look at things and divide them up by revenues or volume or something. You could try to do this in a more sophisticated way, but it's probably not worth the effort, actually. And that's always been a problem, measuring things. And other, you know, a farm often has equipment that's shared around different kinds of crops. How do you apportion to one crop or the other? Complicated. I mean, you make up some rules and you just follow them, basically. Did someone say there's beer here?
Any more questions? No.
Thanks.